Airline Pilot Guy, Episode 20. Hello, I'm Captain Jeff, the Airline Pilot Guy, a show about aviation and this airline pilot's perspective. Got a lot to talk about today, so fasten your seatbelts, sit back, and relax. Acme Flight 20 will be pushing back shortly. And this episode is being recorded live, in quotes, from my hotel room at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in downtown Indianapolis, Indiana. And coming in today, wow, the weather was something else here. Very, very windy. In fact, the winds were, I think, 280 gusting from, I think, 35 gusting to 40. And so the runway heading 227, 280 degrees, about a 50 degree offset. So the crosswind we calculated was getting very, very close to our crosswind limitation of 30 knots. And it was First Officer Brent's leg, and he did a great job. He landed that airplane as good or better than I could, honestly. So he did a fantastic job. And everybody was very impressed with the flight and the landing, especially. So anyway, day two of a three-day trip. Last night I was in Boston. Today, as I just said, Indianapolis. And I'm going to record this thing and then go out and get a bite to eat. And then a very early sign in tomorrow morning, three legs, and then home in the afternoon to Atlanta. So let's see, what shall we start with on this episode? I have a lot of things to talk about, including your feedback, which will take up at least half the show. So I'll try to get some of the subjects I want to talk about at the front here. I'll try to whack those out as quickly as I can, and then we'll get on with the great feedback provided by you, my listeners. Okay, first thing I'd like to start off with is is good news. The airline accident rate for 2011 is the record is a record low. Let's see, the global airline accident rate, it says on this article, this is not quite the end of the year when they wrote this. They said it's on pace this year to reach the lowest recorded, according to the International Air Transportation Association. Let's see, the 2011 rate of 0.34 accidents per million flights is the lowest since World War II, when the modern airline industry began. And that's 68% less than the 1.05 rate in 2001. That was only 10 years ago. This is a long-term trend, this spokesperson said. 2011 is not some kind of anomaly. Let's see. The number of deaths in airline accidents globally are at the lowest levels since 2006, the first year for which IATA reported data in that category on its website. Through November, 486 people have died in air crashes compared with the previous low of 502 in 2008. Okay, that's worldwide data. Now, I believe in the United States, there was a zero fatality rate for 2011. It says Africa is much safer. Cockpit databases that track a plane's location and warn pilots when they get too close to mountaintops and other obstructions have made rare what were once causes of many accidents in Africa. Other safety systems have helped reduce mid-air collisions and wind shear crashes. Africa remains the most dangerous region to fly, according to IATA data. Let's see, there were, or IATA, if you prefer. I always, in my mind, say IATA. There were 3.93 serious accidents per million flights through November. That level was 29% less than the average for the previous 5 years. Latin America was the second most dangerous with 1.43 accidents per million flights. Europe and North Asia had no serious accidents this year. Let's see, not counted. There was a serious accident in about one serious accident in about 10 million flights in North America. Excuse me. According to the group's data, the crash of First Air chartered Boeing 737 in Resolute, Canada, killed 12 people on August 20, according to the Aviation Safety Network, a website that reports accidents. First Air is owned by 9,000 Inuit of northern Quebec. It also does not track crashes involving scheduled and non-scheduled carriers on non-Western-built aircraft. So the year-end numbers won't include the accident at the end of December in Bishkek, Kazakhstan. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, in which a Soviet-made Tupolev Tu-134 crashed while trying to land. At least seven people were injured after the plane broke apart and caught fire. Also not included were things such as the Southwest Airlines fuselage tear. They went into they had a rapid decompression there and landed in Arizona. And you probably remember that in the news. I think that was in August. And no, that was back in April, April 1st to be exact. I talked about it on an earlier episode. And let's see. But the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board considered the incident serious enough to hold a public hearing earlier this year. The tear was traced to a manufacturing error. The most common type of serious accident occurs when an airplane goes off a runway during takeoff or landing. And so now we're kind of concentrating on reducing the accident rate on ground-related accidents. Here's another article that I clipped. Let's see. Some of the recent incidents involving airplanes on the ground were in January of 2010, the U.S. Airways commuter jet rolling off the runway in Charleston, West Virginia, smashing into the safety zone at the end of the strip. In December of 2010, an American Airlines Boeing 757 sliding off the runway in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. You may have seen that YouTube video. Somebody was recording the takeoff roll. No, excuse me, the landing roll in Jackson Hole. And apparently there was some problem with spoilers activating and reverse thrust. And I don't know exactly what the final cause of that accident is, but that was one of those landing incidents. And then, of course, we've had several taxiing incidents. Probably the most famous one was the Air France Super A380 Super Jumbo jet smashing into the tail of the Calm Air commuter jet at Kennedy International Airport in New York. So, anyway, that's good news. Now, the picture for general aviation, which includes private and some corporate flights, is much darker. More than 450 people died in U.S. general aviation accidents last year, amounting to one fatal accident for every 100,000 flight hours. Let's see. So, good news. It's never been safer to fly on airline flights. So, yay for us in the airline industry. We need to keep up the good work. Okay, let's see, what else did I want to talk about here before we get into the feedback today? Oh, this was something I thought was kind of interesting, and it caught my eye. Let's see, let me click on this. This is from the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, the ATSB. Pilots have been warned to take more care with how much fuel they carry after a number of incidents in which planes nearly ran out. It says too many planes have been running out of fuel or switching to the wrong fuel tank during flights. In 2007, a Boeing 737 was carrying passengers from Perth to Sydney. The pilots failed to notice that a critical fuel tank was switched off. And that was what they call a fuel starvation incident. And of course, I was doing some research on this, and I had always thought that fuel starvation was the number one cause or one of the top causes for accidents in general aviation. But it turns out it is in the top 10, but it's about number six or so. The highest accident rate usually has to do with getting too slow and maneuvering in a traffic pattern and just stalling and crashing. And we talked about that in an earlier episode as well. But anyway, so that got me to do some thinking about fuel starvation. And one incident that came to my mind immediately when I heard about airliners running out of fuel was the one that they called the, and now I apologize if I'm mispronouncing this, it's G-I-M-L-I, and I'm going to pronounce it with a hard G, Gimli, could be Gimli, but I'm not sure. The Gimli glider is the nickname of an Air Canada aircraft that was involved in a notable aviation incident in July of 1983. Let's see, Air Canada Flight 143, a 767-200, ran out of fuel at an altitude of 41,000 feet, about halfway through its flight from Montreal to Edmonton via Ottawa. The crew was able to glide the aircraft safely to an emergency landing at the Gimli Industrial Park Airport, a former Canadian Air Force base at Gimli, Manitoba. So, what happened here? Well, turns out that this incident aircraft, was the first one that was delivered to Air Canada that had a different system for calculating fuel. And let's see, let me get back to the part of the article that refers to this. Okay, yeah, it's calibrated for the new system using liters and kilograms instead of gallons and pounds. Now, all airplanes, airliners in the United States that I know of anyway, that I've ever flown or know anything about, calculate the weight of fuel. You know, we don't use gallons. We use, because everything has to do with weight on an airplane. Each passenger's weight, that we use a standard figure for that. Cargo weight and the weight of the fuel, because everything is based on the weight of the airplane as far as speeds and power settings and that kind of thing. So when a fueler puts fuel in an airplane, they work in how many gallons, because that's how much they're going to charge the airline for the fuel. If they put in, you know, 1,000 gallons, then, you know, they multiply by the price per gallon, and that's how much we're charged for the purchase of fuel. We don't care about gallons. We care about pounds of fuel, or the weight of the fuel, and that's what's entered into the calculations. This was the first aircraft that Air Canada was using that had the new system in it that used liters and kilograms. So, for the trip to Edmonton, the pilot calculated a fuel requirement of 22,300 kilograms, which equates to about 49,000 pounds. A dripstick check indicated that there were 7,682 liters, about 2,029 U.S. gallons, already in the tanks. In order to calculate how much more fuel they had to add, the crew needed to convert the quantity in the tanks to a weight, and then subtract that figure from the 22,300 kilograms that you needed to make the flight, and then convert it back into a volume. So, a liter of jet fuel weighs 0.803 kilograms, so the correct calculation was 7,682 liters times 0.803, which equals 6,169 kilograms. So, you subtract that from the 22,300 kilograms required for the flight, and it turns out that they need to add 20,088 liters to the aircraft. Between the ground crew and the flight crew, however, they arrived at an incorrect conversion factor of 1.77. Remember, they were supposed to use the 0.803 factor, but they used the 1.77 figure instead. And the weight, that's actually the weight of a liter of fuel in pounds, the old system. And so this was the conversion factor that was provided on the refueler's paperwork, and which had always been used for the rest of the airline's Imperial calibrated fleet. So if you did those calculations and substitute the 1.77 instead of the 0.803, it turns out that they came up with only 4,916 liters of fuel that had to be added to the airplane. So instead of 22,300 kilograms of fuel, they had 22,300 of pounds, 22,300 pounds on board. Only a little over 10,000 kilograms, or less than half the amount required to reach their destination. So Captain Pearson, the captain of the flight, double-checked their calculations but was given the same incorrect conversion vector. And so he checked the arithmetic and into the flight management computer, the FMC. He put in the wrong figure. So again, he's thinking, everybody's thinking that that airplane has the proper amount of fuel. Again, somewhere between, Ottawa and where were they going? Edmonton. The at 41,000 feet, they received a low fuel indication in the left engine, I believe. Here, let me go back up to the appropriate part of the article. Yes, at 41,000 feet over Red Lake, Ontario, the aircraft's cockpit warning system sounded, indicating a fuel pressure problem on the aircraft's left side. And they assumed a fuel pump had failed, and so the pilots turned it off, since gravity would still feed fuel to the aircraft's two engines. The aircraft's fuel gauges were inoperative, however. So, again, now, so this, you know, most accidents are like this. There's not usually just one thing that goes wrong. There are several things or a chain of events that leads to a major accident. Number one, the incorrect conversion factor used. So they have a lot less fuel than they're supposed to have. And number two, the fuel gauges were inoperative. Now, you're wondering, well, how is it that you can operate an airplane if you have inoperative fuel gauges? Well, we have a big manual, and it's all approved by the FAA or whatever the ruling agency is for the country that says, you know, what things are required and what you can go without. And if you do, then you have to use these procedures, et cetera. So the fuel gauges were inoperative, but the flight management computer indicated that there was still sufficient fuel for the flight. And as the pilot subsequently realized, the entry calculation was incorrect. A few seconds later, a second fuel pressure alarm sounded, prompting the pilots to divert to Winnipeg. Within seconds, the left engine failed, and they began preparing for a single-engine landing. And they were communicating their intentions to controllers in Winnipeg and tried to restart the left engine. When the cockpit warning system sounded again, this time with a long bong that no one present could recall having heard before. And in fact, turns out that they don't even have a simulated sound in the simulator for this, or they didn't at that time. And this was the all engines out sound, an event that had never been simulated during training. Seconds later, most of the instrument panels in the cockpit went blank. Well, maybe they did have the sound programmed into the simulator, so now that I'm reading this again, but they never actually practiced this in the simulator. So the cockpit went blank as the right side engine also stopped, and the 767 lost all power. The 767 was one of the first airliners to include an electronic flight instrument system, EFIS, a system that requires the electricity generated by the aircraft's jet engines in order to operate. With both engines stopped, the system went dead, leaving only a few basic battery-powered emergency flight instruments. Okay, as an aside here, that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important that all pilots at least practice flying their airliners on the standby instruments that they're only going to have for 30 minutes or so or less. That involves, you know, using the steam gauges, as we like to call them, the old-fashioned kind of instrumentation. Anyway, getting back to the article, while these battery-powered instruments, emergency flight instruments, provide a basic information to land the aircraft, the vertical speed indicator was not working. So they did not have a VSI or vertical speed indicator. An airliner is the size of the 767. The engines also supply power for the hydraulic systems, which without which the aircraft cannot be controlled. Such aircraft are therefore required to accommodate this kind of power failure. As with the 767, this is usually achieved through the automated deployment of a ram air turbine, or what we call a RAT, a generator driven by a small propeller, which is in turn driven by the forward motion of the aircraft. As the Gimli pilots were to experience on their landing approach, a decrease in this forward speed means a decrease in the power available to control the aircraft. Okay, so now one of the things going for them, and the reason why so many people survived this this accident, is that Captain Pearson was an experienced glider pilot. And so he started doing some quick calculations about how far they could glide. And he came up just off the top of his head of what the best glide ratio speed would be. And he chose 220 knots, which is 410 kilometers per hour or 250 miles per hour. And so they made the calculations and realized that they were not going to be able to make Winnipeg. And let's see, at this point, the air traffic controllers proposed landing at the former Royal Canadian Air Force Station at Gimli, a closed Air Force base where he had once served as a Canadian Air Force pilot. Oh, Quintal, I guess that's the first officer. Unknown to the first officer, Quintal, part of the facility had been converted to a racetrack complex, now known as the Gimli Motorsports Park. It includes a road race course, a go-kart track, and a drag strip. Furthermore, a CASC amateur sports car race was underway that day, and the area around the decommissioned runway was full of cars and campers. Part of the decommissioned runway itself was being used to stage the race. Without power, the pilots had to try lowering the aircraft's main landing gear via a gravity drop, but due to the airflow, the nose wheel failed to lock into position. The decreasing forward motion of the aircraft also reduced the effectiveness of the ram air turbine, making the aircraft increasingly difficult to control because of the reduced power being generated. As the runway drew nearer, it became apparent that the aircraft was too high and too fast, raising the danger of running off the runway before the aircraft could be stopped. The lack of hydraulic pressure prevented flap and slat extension as well. So these devices, you know, are normally used to reduce the stall speed of the wing or the aircraft for safe landing. So they were flying at a much higher speed. They briefly considered executing a 360-degree turn to reduce the speed and altitude, but decided they did not have enough altitude for that maneuver. So Captain Pearson decided to execute a forward slip to increase drag and lose altitude. We sometimes call that cross-controlling, where you put in, let's say, left rudder, and then you bank the airplane to the right. And that's what is called a forward slip. And this maneuver commonly used with gliders and light aircraft to descend more quickly without gaining forward speed. As soon as the wheels touched the runway, Captain Pearson stood on the brakes, blowing out two of the aircraft's tires. Of course, the anti-skid braking system was not working, so immediately the tires blew. The unlocked nose wheel collapsed and was forced back into its wheel well, causing the aircraft's nose to scrape along the ground. And it turns out that was a good thing, because that really helped stop the airplane. That friction of the nose on the runway was a good thing. None of the 61 passengers was seriously hurt. A minor fire in the nose area was extinguished by racers and course workers armed with fire extinguishers. As the aircraft's nose had collapsed onto the ground, its tail was elevated and there were some minor injuries when passengers exited the aircraft via the rear slides, which were not long enough to accommodate the increased height. Okay, so everybody lived through that incident, the Gimli glider, back in 1983. I remember another one too, but I was unable to find any information about it on Wikipedia or on the internet. But I think it was Air Mexico. It was a Mexican airline that ran out of fuel trying to land at New Orleans, or I don't know if that was the destination or not, but I remember they landed on a levee, and I think it was a 737. But if you know any information about that, send it to me, because that was an interesting one as well. And I believe everybody walked away from that one as well. And another high-profile fuel starvation accident was one that occurred a few years after the Gimli glider in 1983, this time in 1990, an Avianca Flight 52, which was a Boeing 707, started its journey in Bogota, Colombia, stopping in Medellin after flying for half an hour, and then it took off a few minutes later at 3:08 p.m., and headed to New York, John F. Kennedy International Airport. Flight 52 was much delayed in approaching its destination due to congestion and bad weather, It had been in a holding pattern off the coast near New York for over one hour due to fog and wind interfering with smooth arrivals and departures into JFK. During this hold, the aircraft was exhausting its reserve fuel supply, which would have allowed it to divert to its alternate Boston in case of an emergency or other critical situation. When first put on hold, the crew of Flight 52 thought that they would be landing soon, after a few aircraft also on hold in front of them had landed. The bad weather, wind shear, and other factors caused the pilots of these aircraft to abort their landings, and the hold time increased. 77 minutes after entering the holding pattern, the New York Air Traffic Control Center asked the crew how long they could continue to hold, to which the first officer replied, "About 5 minutes." The first officer then stated that their alternate was Boston, but since they had been holding for so long, they would not be able to make it there anymore. Even though Flight 52 had fuel issues, ATC passed the flight to another person, presumably unaware that there was any urgency to landing this airplane. The delay of the handover may have increased the pilot's stress and fear response, which may have led to less than optimal piloting. The new controller then cleared the aircraft for an approach to runway 22 left at Kennedy and informed the flight of a wind shear at 1,500 feet. As Flight 52 flew the ILS approach, they encountered the wind shear at an altitude of less than 500 feet, or 150 meters. As a result, the plane descended below the planned glide slope and almost crashed into the ground short of the runway. The pilots were forced to abandon the landing, even though they knew the plane did not have enough fuel to turn around for another attempt. The crew alerted the controller that they were low on fuel and, in a subsequent transmission, stated, "We're running out of fuel, sir." The controller then asked the crew to climb, to which the first officer replied, "No, sir, we're running out of fuel." Moments later, with the airplane still very close to the ground, the number 4 engine flamed out, shortly followed by the other 3. With the aircraft's main source of electrical power, generators driven off of its engines, now gone, automatic load shedding would have caused many non-essential electrical systems to lose power. The cabin thus would have plunged into darkness. With no engine thrust, the plane lost height. It plunged into the small village of Cove Neck on northern Long Island in Oyster Bay, about 15 miles from the airport. The aircraft struck the ground and slid down a hill into the town, splitting into 2 pieces as it reached the bottom. The impact snapped off the cockpit, which landed over 100 feet away in the side of an unoccupied house. 85 people survived the crash with injuries, while 73 passengers and crew died. All right. The National Transportation Safety Board, their report on the accident determined that the cause was pilot error due to the crew never declaring a fuel emergency to air traffic control as per the International Air Transport Association guidelines, IATA. The crew asked for a priority landing, which, because of language differences between English and Spanish, can be interpreted as an emergency to Spanish-speaking pilots, but not to English-speaking air traffic controllers. This may have caused some confusion amongst the pilots when ATC confirmed their priority status. Some NTSB board members felt that ATC was negligent in not providing arriving aircraft with the latest wind shear information, which could alert the crew to possible difficulties in landing. So, it was a tragedy. Many people died that didn't need to because of, a communication breakdown, basically, and some bad judgment. Let me play the some of the ATC audio from that the last minute or two of the flight.
Avianca 052, heavy New York, good evening, climb maintain 3000.
Climbing
up 10,000 and we're running out of system. Okay, fly heading at 082. And Avianca 052, heavy, I'm going to bring you about 15 miles northeast and then turn you back on for the approach. Is that fine with you and your fuel?
I guess so, thank you very much.
I guess so.
Avianca 52, climb maintain 3,000.
Negative, sir. We're just running out of fuel. We're good. Okay, 3,000, I'll be good.
Okay, turn left heading 310, sir.
310, Avianca 052. Avianca 052, we just lost two engines and we need the priority, please.
Avianca 052, turn left heading 250, intercept the localizer.
Roger.
Avianca 052, you have enough fuel to make it to the airport?
Okay. That was the last transmission.
Avianca 052, radar contact lost.
Well, that was the last transmission by the air traffic controller, radar contact lost. I was kind of taken back a little bit by the tone of this guy's voice on the radio. Maybe he was just, you know, he just realized that their fate was sealed after they had to go around, and knowing that they did not have enough fuel to make it back around for another approach. I don't know. If I thought that, I think I would have headed out over water or something. I don't know. I wasn't there, so just be second-guessing the events of that night. Anyway, so that is fuel starvation. It's important that we always make sure that we have enough fuel required, and if we are running low on fuel, we need to immediately recognize that. And at ACME, we have a couple different stages. If we think that we're going to land at our destination with or alternate destination with less than the minimum fuel level, then we declare minimum fuel, which alerts the air traffic controllers that we need priority handling. In other words, we want to be first in line for everything as far as getting into an airport. And then if we calculate that we're going to arrive at our destination or alternate with emergency fuel levels, and each airplane has a different level or less, we declare emergency fuel. And that basically means that you have control of the situation as far as, you know, you can do whatever you need to do to get the airplane safely on the ground. And that's one of the emergency authority is something that we as captains can exercise when it is appropriate. In this situation, I guess, again, because of the Spanish-speaking, English-speaking differences and nuances, they just didn't really make it clear to the American air traffic controllers that, hey, we're in a bad situation. We need to get the airplane on the ground. And perhaps if they had communicated that, this would have had a happy ending. So, again, fuel starvation. So let me go back here to my outline and see what else I wanted to talk about before we did our feedback. Yeah, it's going to be another long show. I can just feel it. Sorry. talk about hotels. Hotels. I saw this, I think it was a tweet that I saw from Barbara DeLolis from USA Today. She writes a travel column. And she posed this question: would you ever complain that the hotel room you were assigned was too big? I'm being serious. Steve Kokanias, general manager of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia's capital, recently mentioned this strange-sounding complaint via his Twitter account, and it caught my eye. In the United States, after all, we're all about bigger is better, right? So I asked Steve to tell me more. And lucky for us, he's a good writer, and I'm pretty sure that many of you will find his thoughtful reply interesting. Let's see. First, let me set it up for you. The guests Kokanias referred to had originally booked a basic executive deluxe room, but the hotel was packed and those rooms were full, so the Ritz-Carlton upgraded them for free into one of the extra spacious two-bedroom residences in its all-suites tower. After they complained, the hotel moved the guests, who were Asian, back to the main tower to a smaller room the following day. Now, folks, this is Jeff speaking. The Ritz-Carlton, nice property, nice hotel. And so they went from their, what did they call that? Their smaller room, I forgot what they called that, executive deluxe room. After being assigned to, well, they went from this room that, well, they never got there because they didn't have any of those available, and they got the extra spacious two-bedroom residence in its all-suites tower. Man, that must have been nice. I would never turn that down for sure. Anyway, The Kokanias, an American who has lived in Asia for 9 years, further elaborates about what appears to be a lesson in cultural differences. This is not the first time we've experienced a guest asking for a smaller room. Three factors appear to be at play. Number one, some guests prefer the coziness of a standard room. The fact that the bathroom, closet, and front door are nearby has an appeal for some. Culturally, some guests only want to, quote, get what they paid for, and find it inappropriate to be given a room much larger than what was purchased, as if they would then owe us something in return, which is, of course, not true. It's our pleasure. And number three, and you may find this one very strange, but we have had, on more than one occasion, received complaints from guests that their suite was too big and that they felt a presence or unwanted spirit occupying the extra bedroom or living room area and wanted to be moved to something smaller where they were the only guest in the room. You will find that these stories of enhanced spirituality, read ghosts, are quite common in Southeast Asia. So, that reminded me of a couple different instances laying over in a hotel we stayed in New Orleans. We're not staying there anymore, called the Intercontinental. And they always treated us crew members very, very nicely. And if the availability was there, in other words, the number of folks staying in the hotel was below a certain point, they would sometimes upgrade us to the suites on the top floor of the hotel. And let me tell you what, these things were nice. I mean, it was like the size of a house. You walk in and it was multiple rooms, living room, a couple bedrooms, a couple bathrooms. It was very, very, very nice. A couple fireplaces. And what was interesting about that is that my co-pilot on one of these trips, and we got in very late, and we didn't leave until late the next day. And the next day, when we were, you know, picking up for our pickup time in the hotel lobby and on the trip to the airport, he was telling me that he really didn't like having such a large space. Again, he felt that he wanted to have everything close by. He wanted his suitcase and everything else near him. And I'm thinking, well, you know, that's what I did. I put my suitcase very close to the bed or on the bed. I don't remember what. So I really couldn't see why he was complaining about having this huge. In fact, I think his room, his suite, was actually larger than mine. But so I guess it's true for some people that they really don't like those big suites. They'd rather have a smaller room. So what do you think about that? Have you ever been in a situation where you were upgraded to a suite? And did you like that? Would you rather have a smaller room? Hey, if you want small rooms, stay in some of these New York hotels. I mean, I've been in some rooms in New York where there's just enough room to put a bed in, and honestly, I don't know how they got the bed into the room to begin with. And there was just barely enough room for me to kind of walk sideways along the foot of the bed to get to the other side of the bed. I mean, very, very small, the size of a walk-in closet, basically. Anyway, so I thought that was kind of strange. So give me some feedback about that. You like big rooms, small rooms, in between? Let me know. And you can do that by sending your feedback to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com or calling area code 304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. And the last thing I want to talk about before we get to the feedback is turbulence and the importance of making sure that you always have your seatbelt fastened at all times. I was just flying back from Orlando. I drove down from Charlotte to Orlando with my daughter, and then I flew a flight from Orlando back to Atlanta on the jump seat, but they had seats in the back, so that's proper etiquette to offer to sit in the back so you're not crowding the pilots up front. And so there were several seats back there, and I went ahead and took one of those seats, sitting next to a guy that was, for most of the flight, had his seatbelt off. And I thought to myself, that's not very smart, because you can't rely on getting a warning from the cockpit that we're about to experience some turbulence, because you know what? Sometimes we don't know it's about to occur. So let's look at this article, Severe Turbulence Injures 7, on a Qantas Airbus A380 Super Jumbo. This is in USA Today. Seven passengers were injured when the Qantas A380 encountered turbulence so severe that several flyers were lifted out of their seats and thrown into the ceiling, according to eyewitness accounts from customers on the Saturday morning flight. I love this one. The Qantas flight hit the, quote, air pocket. There's no such thing as an air pocket. I mean, there are changes in wind speed. There are vertical updrafts and downdrafts, but there's no such thing as an air pocket. What's going to be inside of an air pocket? Air. And that's what you're flying in anyway, right? But I know that's the common term people use when they hit turbulence. They hit an air pocket. Anyway, they hit this air pocket over Indian airspace on its way from London to Singapore, and they were out over the Indian Ocean, I believe. And let's see. Here are some quotes from some of the passengers. It was pretty scary. We literally went up to the roof. Many people weren't in seatbelts, one passenger says to ABC News. Another passenger tells ABC News he saw injuries that included broken bones and cuts. I believe someone's head went through an overhead locker, apparently, or cracked it or something. They have some pictures here of some of the holes in the ceiling and the overhead bin space. People were screaming and shouting as the plane was powerfully shaken up and down three times. Let's see. The seatbelt sign had come on, but some passengers were still moving back to their seats. Okay, so apparently they didn't really have any warning that they were going to enter this area of turbulence, or if they did have any warning, it was a very short period of time. And they did turn on the seatbelt light, and they warned people to return to their seats. But, hey, you know what happens. You're out there in an airplane, and you see the seatbelt light come on. You hear an announcement from the cockpit and from the flight attendants, and you think, oh, no problem, I have time to get back to my seat. Well, you may not. So that's one instance of severe turbulence that injured several passengers, some severely. And the other one was another Qantas flight. And but this one didn't have anything to do with turbulence. It was blamed on a computer. Damage to the fittings above passenger seats caused by the plunge of the Qantas flight. Let's see, a wild ride mid-flight on a Qantas Airbus that left a third of the passengers on board injured as they were tossed out of their seats has been traced to a computer programming glitch. In the culmination of a three-year probe into the incident, which occurred at 37,000 feet over the Indian Ocean off the coast of Western Australia, they found that the plane twice dived unexpectedly after one of three airspeed sensors malfunctioned. This was an Airbus 330, the same type of airplane that Air France was flying over the Atlantic Ocean, and they had a malfunction on the airspeed sensors. And in that case, it was a bad ending. Everybody died in that crash. So I guess the incorrect data to the computers led the autopilot to do some very, very strange things. Let's see. Suddenly, the plane nosedived. Passengers not wearing seatbelts and standing crew hit the ceiling when the plane plunged 150 feet in 2 seconds as part of a 690-foot, 23-second dive. 2 minutes later, it plunged a second time when the flight computer instructed the plane to pitch downwards again, plunging 400 feet in 15 seconds. Pilots broadcast a mayday and sought an immediate emergency landing at the nearest runway, which was at Learmonth and on the mid-northwest coast of Western Australia. Adding to the injuries and flight computer dramas, the automatic cabin pressurization system malfunctioned during the descent, as did the aircraft's auto-braking system. So it was not a good day to be on this particular Qantas flight, nor the other one, for that matter. So, folks, I know even if you don't get a warning about turbulence, you should always have your seatbelts fastened. Hey, that's what we do up at the flight deck. Right, pilots listening to this? If you're in your seat, you have your seatbelt on, because you never know. You just never know. Okay, it is time for your feedback. So let me do a little click on this tag here and filter out some of the stuff that I'm looking at and get right to it, because I have a lot of it. And again, it's going to be a very long show, so bear with me if you don't mind. Well, let's start with, because I always love audio feedback. Let's start with this.
Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Mike from Indiana. I just ixnay on the Elphone Say business. I do not want people speaking on their cell phone throughout a flight, whether or not it interferes with your guidance. Any regulator who allows that should be condemned to sitting in the middle seat between people yapping loudly on their cell phone for the rest of their lives. Keep up the good work. I really enjoy each episode. Take care and happy flying.
Hey, thanks, Mike from Indiana. I'm probably close to you somewhere. I think you said in a small town outside of Indianapolis, where I'm recording this right now. And I always enjoy your feedback, Mike, and thank you for doing that. And I agree with you. I think that if for any reason at all that cell phones should be banned for use on an airplane, it's because I don't want to hear anybody yakking about this or that sitting next to me. I really don't. So, and I love the way he started. Did you notice that? He said, ixnay on the Elphone Say, the old Igpe Atenlay, Pig Latin. That's one of the languages that I do speak, English and Pig Latin. Again, thanks for your feedback, Mike. Keep sending it in if you don't mind. Here's some more audio feedback, this time from my friend PJ.
Hey, Captain Jeff, it's your pal PJ from Houston here. I just have a quick question this time, much shorter than my previous messages. But hey, I have a quick little pilot oriented question. You keep talking about how you're always bidding for the morning trips. I was wondering if that affects your night currency at all, if you're able to still maintain the three landings at night within 90 days that the FAA requires for you to carry passengers at night, or if that even applies in 121 flying. Just kind of a mild curiosity I thought of when I was listening to your most recent episode on the way into work this morning. But I know that you can't necessarily grab the MD-80 and go bang out three stop-and-goes before you take passenger flight, like we can, the GA guys can with a Cessna. But so I was kind of curious how that works if you do wind up losing your night currency. Anyway, enjoying the podcast still. I always move your podcast up to the top of the backlog whenever I see a new episode come out. So it's a great listen. I always enjoy it, and look forward to the next one. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thanks, PJ, and I always enjoy your feedback as well. And I was wondering, when you sent me that voicemail, I'm thinking, I never seem to have to worry about my night currency. Nobody ever talks about it. So I did some research, and I found this on Airline Pilot Central forums, and the subject was about takeoff and landing currency on Part 121. The Federal Aviation Regulations, FARs, Part 121 is that part that regulates or governs scheduled air carriers like the airlines. I know you know that, PJ, but just in case folks out there listening who are not pilots, they might be confused about that. So, all the big airlines, American, Delta, United, are Part 121 carriers. And under Part 121, both the pilot in command and second in command must make three takeoffs and landings within the past 90 days, day, night, IMC, which is instrument meteorological conditions, or VMC, which is visual meteorological conditions, they don't matter. So night currency for Part 121 is not a factor, nor is instrument conditions or anything. This will provide 121 landing and IFR currency. Technically, the Part 91 rule does not apply since 121 pilots do not have to do the night landings for night currency. However, if you are a current 121 pilot who flies general aviation under Part 91, you must meet all the usual Part 91 rules. So, if you're an airline pilot who also flies light aircraft on the side, you can be 100% airline current but 0% general aviation current. So I hope that clears up that for you, PJ. And that was a good question because, when you first posed it, I thought, I'm not really sure about that. But so, yeah, I can't just go in and, get the keys to the MD-88 and fly a couple turns around the pattern at night to maintain my night currency. But it turns out that I really don't need to do that anyway, do I? So, again, Thanks for the feedback. Keep sending it in. And this piece of feedback is from Down Under in Sydney, Australia. Hello, I recently started listening to Airline Pilot Guy after hearing you on the SQPN Pan Am show. It's really interesting to hear stories from your side of the cockpit door. Pan Am isn't showing in my corner of the world yet, so I've watched it via the free episodes on iTunes. I really like the concept of the show. I hope that Sony and ABC don't cancel it. Anyway, I saw this news piece about a flying shark spotted above Christchurch Airport and thought you'd get a giggle from it. Just when you thought it was safe to re-enter Christchurch airspace this summer, shark! The pilot of a passenger jet thought to be an Air New Zealand flight was on his descent to Christchurch International Airport on Boxing Day when he radioed ground control with an unlikely sighting, a shark flying at several thousand feet. The fish out of water was identified as a remote-controlled helium-filled shark that has topped must-have present lists this Christmas. The 1.44-meter-long air swimmer toy, it's about 5 feet long, I think, has a radio receiver attached to its underside and can be operated by remote control over a range of 15 miles? Must be meters. No, maybe miles. Wow. Designer-developer William Mark Corporation warns that the shark is for strictly indoor use only. A spokeswoman for air traffic control company Airways, Monica Davis, said a pilot had reported the shark and its location about 9 kilometers from the airport at 2 p.m. on December 26th. We advised subsequent traffic of its location, but no one else reported seeing it. So that was an interesting thing. I guess a helium-filled shark was sighted by an Air New Zealand flight. That's crazy. Hey, thanks for sending me the feedback, Kelly. Appreciate it. And as long as we're talking about Down Under, I've been talking about that a lot on this podcast. We had the two Qantas incidents and then the previous feedback from Kelly. And this is from Tim, also in Sydney. Hey, Tim, do you know Kelly? Kelly, do you know Tim? Let's see. G'day, Captain Jeff from Sydney, Australia. I've only recently found your podcast after being a big fan of some of the other blogs. Captain Dave at Flight Level 3. You know what? I've already read this one. So never mind. You'll recall that Tim had asked about doing a day in the life of a commercial captain hauling people bags and mail all over the United States. And you know what, Tim? You'll be happy to know that I've started doing that. I have a little lapel mic that I can plug into my iPhone. And I've been on this trip so far. I've been making several recordings. And one of these days, I'll compile it all together and try to give you all a picture of what it's like to be a air crew member for a major airline. So, sorry about reading that again, but I just wanted, I know why I did that, to give you a status update. So the status is, yes, I'm doing it. Thanks for your suggestion, Tim. Okay, well, let me see if I can recover from this. Received this from Jen in Northern California, and she sent me a link to a YouTube video, and she says, basically, this band flew United Airlines to Nebraska for a concert and damaged someone's $3,500 guitar. The buck got passed for months, and they finally said it wasn't their problem. The singer told the last person he talked to that he would write 3 songs about the experience. This is the first one, and he has gotten 11 million views so far. So let's take a listen to United Breaks Guitars.
United, you broke my Taylor guitar. United Breaks Guitars.
Hello, Captain Jeff. I am Colin O'Brien from the Minneapolis area, and I'm 13. I have a couple questions. The first is, what would be the right path to becoming an airliner pilot? Like, I'm in the Civil Air Patrol, and I'm going through the Young Eagle program. And, yeah, about that. And then Acme, oh yeah, and I just started listening like yesterday, but Acme Airlines, what exactly is that? I haven't been able to find that. And your airplane that you fly most often. And I just wanted to know some stories and stuff about Minneapolis International Airport. Like some pros, some cons, what you like, what you dislike. And have you ever flown there? And like most likely if you were to fly there, what you would fly there in and where to. But yeah, that's it. I watch your podcast a lot. Thank you very much and bless you.
Well, thank you very much, Colin. Yeah, I fly into Minneapolis, St. Paul all the time. In fact, that was my first leg of the trip that I'm on right now. We flew from Atlanta to Minneapolis, St. Paul. You asked about Acme Airlines. Well, Acme is an airline that I made up. Now, I hope there's really not an Acme airline out there. I did a search for it, and I couldn't find it, so I assumed that I was safe to use that name. And the reason why I use Acme instead of the actual name of the airline that I fly for, and by the way, they're pretty big up there in Minneapolis and Atlanta, is because I really haven't received official permission from my company to do a podcast. And so I don't want people to think that I'm an official spokesperson for this big legacy airline that flies all around the world. And because most of what I talk about here is my opinion about things. And again, don't want it misconstrued as the official word from airline A, airline B, airline C, whatever. So I made up the airline name Acme. So that's why you can't find it. So anyway, so that's why I use that. And let's see, what else did you ask about? Oh, what's the best path to becoming an airline pilot? Well, there are many paths, and it really has to do with where you are as far as your age. You're young. You're in a great position, by the way, Colin. And it depends on, you know, what time you're living in history. For me, getting onto the major airlines was kind of tough unless you were a military trained pilot. So a big chunk of folks that were hired in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s were former military pilots. Now, do you have to be a military pilot to be an airline pilot? No. It's just that seemed to be the kind of pilot that the airlines were interested in hiring at the time. Now, there were civilian trained pilots that were hired as well, but just not as large a proportion. Now, the civilian route is actually the more popular and probably expeditious route now to get to the airlines. There are several ways to do it. Being involved in the Civil Air Patrol, or whatever you called it, that you talked about in your voicemail, is a good way to start out. And then you can get your private pilot's license and work on your ratings and be a flight instructor. That's one way. There are schools out there specifically set up to teach you how to fly in a very, very short period of time and give you the ratings that are necessary to be hired by what we call commuter airlines or regional airlines, you know, airlines like, let's see, ASA, Atlantic Southeast, which is now, what, ExpressJet, many different Chautauqua, Pinnacle, a lot of different airlines out there, again, regional airlines. And so I think you can get through one of those courses in as little as, I don't know, 6 months, maybe even less than that, or maybe up to about a year. It's expensive, though. You have to get, either your mom and dad have to have a lot of money, or you have to have a lot of money, or you have to borrow a lot of money to pay for your training in these things. And I think I've heard from some folks that I've flown with that you could find some of these advanced or really quick ways to get all your ratings and time for under $50,000. But the figure that I keep hearing over and over again is around $60,000 to $75,000. That's a lot of money. Another way to do it is to find several colleges and universities around the country that have flight crew or flight training programs as well. I went to one, Auburn University, although I wasn't in the what they called the professional flight option at the time, because I knew that I was going, going to go into the Air Force, and they were going to train me how to fly. I did graduate at Auburn University with a degree in aviation management, so I was studying about aviation and such, but wasn't doing the actual flying at the school. But they do have a program where you can get the degree in aviation management and also do the flying and get your ratings and such. There are a lot of schools out there that offer really, really good programs. Purdue is another big one. Embry-Riddle, that's a four-year college. And the nice thing about these programs is that not only do you get the ratings that you need to get hired by some of the regional airlines, but you also get a four-year college degree. Now you're asking, is a college degree something that's really required to fly an airplane? Well, no, but when you're being considered by a major airline and they're comparing one dude like Colin with another guy, let's say Jeff, and Colin has a four-year degree and Jeff does not, they're going to pick you, Colin, because you have a four-year college degree. So it's just a way for airlines to discriminate when it comes to, and I mean discriminate in a good way. And so if you go through one of these really fast programs, a lot of them down in Florida, where you pay your $60,000, $70,000 and up to get all your ratings and time and such in a short period of time, eventually, even if you're flying for a regional airline, you're going to want to go to school at a local, maybe a community college or a local four-year college or whatever, to eventually get your college degree. Because if you want to fly for the majors, that may change because they're predicting pilot shortages here. So maybe a college degree won't even be something even people think about anymore in the future. But right now, if you want to get on by a major, you got to have a college degree as well. So basically, you go through the military, which is not such a great option anymore, really, because they require you to commit to a very long time after they've done all the spent all the money on your training. They want you to stay in for quite a bit of time. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I think the commitment now is like 10 or 11 years after you get your wings. And getting your wings is about a year-long process. And then if you're not a commissioned officer when you start your training, then you're going to have to go to officer training school, as I did, or you're going to have to do the ROTC program at your college. And, oh, by the way, you have to be a college graduate to get into the military flight training programs because you are an officer first and a pilot second. So you're looking at getting a four-year college degree and then going into pilot training and then another 10 years after that. So let's see. Let's all add all that up, and looks like about at least 15 years from the point that you enter college to the time you're getting out of the military and getting hired by the airline. So it's a tougher road now, and I would probably steer people away from that, although I think that my military training was awesome. And I think that you get to see things in the military that you don't get to see in the civilian world. So I'm not saying that going into the military is a bad thing. Far from it. It's just that if you want to get into the airlines as fast as possible, you need to probably find a different route. Now, kind of a hybrid option, and this is something I didn't know about until I was in officer training school. And by then it was too late because I'd already raised my hand and committed myself to an Air Force commitment of at least a little over 7 years. But I met a guy in at officer training school, and he was telling me about the reserve unit that he was in. And I'd never heard of the Air Force Reserves or the Air National Guard. And it turns out that you're an officer and you go to the military flight training program, just like everybody else, and then you're assigned to your unit. And I think you can, if you can get hired by a commuter airline or a major airline right away, you probably won't because you probably don't have enough experience or time to do that. But you don't necessarily have to wait until you're out of the reserves or the guard to start flying for the airlines. You can do it at the same time. In fact, we have a lot of guys and gals at Acme and other major carriers that are still active military pilots, and they're in the local reserve, or well, not even local, but in one of the reserve units or guard units, and they do that at the same time as being an airline pilot, flying their trips, and then you know every month for a few days they fly a trip in their reserve unit. So that's another thing to look into. So I hope that helps. I know that's not definitive, like, Colin, I think this is what you should do, but at least that gives you some ideas to explore. And if I find out more information about all those routes, and I'm sure that people listening right now are thinking, oh, Jeff, you forgot about this and you forgot about that, and let me clarify what you said was wrong. And speaking of that, of making corrections, I need to make a correction to something that I said on my last podcast. This is from Dan. Dan is also a pilot for Acme Airlines, I'm pretty sure. And he said, enjoyed your recent show. John Nance was an Alaska pilot prior to retiring to write more books and take on a bigger role as an aviation consultant at ABC News. Okay, so I think I said that John Nance was an NTSB investigator before he got his gig with as an aviation consultant with ABC. I was wrong. He was just a plain old line pilot like me. Well, I'm assuming he was a line pilot, but he flew for Alaskan. And also, he says, and we on the DC-9 at Acme use the RMI all the time for situational awareness. We don't have a nice map. We will come December on the next plane. So I think that Dan is in training for another airplane at Acme. And now I went and listened back to just to make sure, because what I was talking about was the ADF, the Automatic Direction Finder navigational aid. And you view the ADF needle through something that's called an RMI. And so I wasn't talking about the RMI not being necessary or not being an important tool for us or instrument for us, on the contrary. I think that I still use it. I tune in VORs, and I still use the RMI to maintain situational awareness as well, even though I do have a nice moving map display that gives a great situational awareness. But what I was talking about, Dan, was the ADF, the Automatic Direction Finder navigational aid. So anyway, hope that clears things up. Thanks for listening so intently and keenly, Dan. And if I say something wrong again, which I'm sure I will, maybe I already have in this episode, please be sure to send in a correction, because I don't want to give people bad information. Okay, let's see. This from David Derazinski. He sent me this link from Margie Goldsmith, and I think she is a columnist or writer for... Oh, I must have eliminated that from my Evernote clipping. Well, anyway, Margie, I'm sorry, Margie, I don't know where you're from, but she writes, American Airlines captain gives passengers too much information. We've all experienced annoying airport flight delays, but most of the time we never learn the reason for the holdup. However, on a recent American Airlines flight from Dallas to Jackson Hole, the captain himself gave us a little too much information, leading me to wonder if someone had injected him with truth serum. Flight 2599 was scheduled to depart Dallas at 5:10 p.m., but was delayed to 6:10. This was slightly irritating, but no one went off the deep end because it would now arrive in Jackson only 1 hour later. Besides, no one was about to go ski or go on a wildlife safari to Yellowstone at 8 or 9 p.m. However, at the designated time, we boarded the plane, we sat, and sat, and sat. After about a half an hour, a garbled Midwestern voice came from the loudspeakers. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. I'm sorry for the delay, but we were delayed 2 hours coming in from Vancouver. He paused. We seem to have a little problem. Our hydraulics are leaking, and it wouldn't really be a good idea if we tried to fly that way. Not a good idea at all. I'm sure you'd all agree. He paused again. So the technicians are going to come and try to fix it, and we'll be off the ground as soon as they do. Everyone remained absolutely silent. Also, he continued, I've flown into Jackson many, many times in my life. I used to fly there all the time, but I haven't flown into there in 2 years, and it's kind of a tricky approach. So before we take off, I'm going to go have to watch a video. It's required. I'm going to get off the jetway now, and I'll be back in 40 minutes. What? The person behind me said. Why didn't he watch it during his two-hour delay in Vancouver? This is absurd. We all agreed and grumbled. We sat, and we sat, and we sat. 40 minutes later, the captain was back. Ladies and gentlemen, came his cheery voice in the loudspeaker. Unfortunately, they are unable to fix the hydraulics, so we're going to have to change planes. And it will take about an hour to get the new plane out of the hangar, clean it, and get it ready at the gate. You may now deplane, but please check the departure signs because we don't know which gate the new plane will arrive at. We all pulled our suitcases from the overhead bins and reassembled in the boarding area. Most of the passengers were furious, but I consider the fact that we were leaving at all a blessing. The last thing I wanted was to spend the night in an airport hotel. At least now, no matter what time we arrived in Jackson Hole, I'd wake up and look out at the Grand Tetons. Almost 2 hours went by when finally they announced American Airlines Flight 2599 to Jackson Hole was now boarding. It was another Boeing 757, so we took our same seats as the captain announced. Welcome back. Sorry about the long wait, but the plane had to be cleaned. And I don't just mean the seats needed to be cleaned. The restrooms were really smelly, and the whole plane smelled foul. And we certainly weren't going to let you on board with it smelling like that. That would be a horrible way to fly. Again, we were silent. We fastened our seatbelts and rolled away from the gate. It was now 9:30. At least we were leaving. But we sat on the runway. There were no planes ahead of us. This was strange. There had to be a new situation. Suddenly, the captain's voice boomed again on the loudspeaker. Well, folks, we seem to have a new problem. The left door, just in front of the engines, won't close. And because it's right in front of the engine, we don't think flying would be a very wise decision. I'm sure you agree, so we're going back to the gate and fix it. 10 minutes later, we were all sitting at the gate. The captain announced, we're going to have two mechanics out there, and what they're going to do is take the door completely off and then put duct tape. She wrote duct tape, but it's actually duct tape. All around the edges. That's right, folks. Duct tape. And then they're going to put the door back on, and that'll keep it closed for our flight. No one said a word. Duct tape? Was he serious? Half an hour later, we taxied down the runway with no further mechanical problems and off. And 3 hours later, arrived in Jackson Hole. There had been a 5-hour delay, but better safe than sorry. The next time I'm on a delayed flight and the captain does not announce the reason for the holdup, I think I'm going to be one happy passenger. Okay, where to start with this? I must say that I think that there are several mistakes made here. Margie, I think, either misunderstood what the captain said, or perhaps the captain wasn't very clear about explaining what he was talking about. Now, I think I can read between the lines of what has happened here. When he came on, and after a half an hour of no announcement and being delayed at the gate, someone should have said something. And apparently, if I'm taking Margie's word for it, there was no announcement until the captain came on. But he mentioned that they were delayed 2 hours from coming in from Vancouver. Well, that could be for several reasons. They could have been delayed on the airport for an air traffic control delay. It could have been a weather delay. Could have been many different things. A mechanical delay. Obviously, they didn't say. So they're coming in. They're late, and they probably had to go, switch airplanes, which we do in the major hubs a lot of times. And then they had to make it to the next flight. So instead of using a reserve crew, they used the same crew that was originally scheduled to fly the thing. And so he's late. So he's apologizing for that. Again, he didn't go into a lot of detail. And I guess he thought he didn't really need to. But he gave the impression, I think, that this 2-hour delay in Vancouver was something that they were just sitting around and they could have viewed videos. I have a feeling, again, that they had probably, that it was probably a taxiing delay. They were out there in the airplane where you can't view a video. It also could be that they weren't the original air crew scheduled to fly this flight. Maybe the original crew was somewhere else. And so the reason why this guy had to view this video, there are some airports that we have called restricted airports. And if we haven't been in there for a certain amount of time, then we were required to view these FAA-approved videos. It gives us information and viewpoints, perspectives, looking at the airport. And they're usually challenging airports to fly into, for instance, Jackson Hole. And every 2 years, we were required to view these materials and then sign them off. And so he probably hadn't. And because he didn't probably think that he was flying to Jackson Hole that night. And so I'm going to have to give him a break on that. Again, maybe he didn't communicate that very well. And again, I don't think that he would have, if he had known he was flying to Jackson Hole during the 2 hour delay in Vancouver, he probably would have viewed the video in Vancouver. And the other thing that I should throw in as well is that I don't know if American has a crew base in Vancouver. And you can't just view these videos anywhere that we fly. They're in special locations. So chances are he didn't have a chance to view the Jackson Hole video in Vancouver. So the comment about this is absurd. What? Why didn't he watch it during his 2 hour delay in Vancouver? Well, he probably couldn't have. Okay, so they fixed the hydraulics, and, well, no, they couldn't fix the hydraulics. Okay, that's not unusual. That's going to take longer to fix, so they're going to get a new airplane. Yeah, that makes sense. And I agree with him. If you bring an airplane that's been sitting out in the sun all day long and it just smells horrid, I mean, I've gotten on some airplanes that smelled so bad that it made you want to, it made you nauseated. Just put it that way. Really, like, made you gag. And so I don't blame them for not boarding until they had that situation fixed. Okay, the duct tape door incident. No, we don't use duct tape. We use something called speed tape and some other specialized tapes to seal up things like plug doors for pressurization and such. He probably wanted to be a little colloquial and kind of give it, explain it in terms that passengers who are not pilots and mechanics would understand, and perhaps he simplified that a little bit too much. And so you're thinking, you're going to put duct tape on the outside of a door to keep it closed. No. The duct tape, again, or the speed tape or whatever type of specialized tape they were using, was to make a good seal. Again, these doors are not, they don't fling open. They are actually held in place by hinges and other latches and such, and then once the airplane is pressurized, the door is closed for good. It's not going to come open. It can't. If the airplane is pressurized, the door will not open. But you know, he didn't want to fly the airplane with the door with a leak and not sealing properly and getting a bad indication, so he did the right thing and got it fixed. Again, I think it was perhaps some bad communication on his part. So I am one, and I think you've heard me say this before, that communicates quite often with my passengers. I try to use terms that people can understand, and I try to explain it in such a way. But, you know, sometimes I'm sure that I say something that probably wasn't said the best way I could have. And after thinking about it a little bit, I'm thinking, you know, I wish I had said it this way or whatever. I can't be back there and sit next to each and every passenger and explain it to all of you in the best way that I can for that particular passenger. So I do my best and hope that my communication to you, my passengers, is understood. But in this case, I don't think that he gave too much information. I just think that the information that he gave could have been given a little bit better. Well, you know what? I think I still have some more feedback that I wanted to read, and I know that I'm way long on this podcast. I apologize for that. If you're still hanging in there with me, I know it's well over an hour. Thank you. And I promise that I'll try to do a better job of keeping the amount of time that I'm spending recording this down to a more manageable level. And with that, I guess I'll shut up because I'm just making this thing even longer. Again, if you want to send me feedback, send it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Or if you listen to me also on Catholic Pilot, my CatholicPilot.com feed, you can send it to feedback@CatholicPilot.com. But If you're just listening to the normal Airline Pilot Guy feed, send it to feedback at Airline Pilot Guy. Either way, I'll get it. And the number for both shows is area code 304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. And until next time, I hope you have a great week and weekend, and hopefully I'll get another one of these things cranked out next week so I can keep it a little bit shorter. And so until we meet again, wishing you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.